The following is an interview with Dana G. Meade, M-E-A-D, Associate Director of the Domestic Council. The interview was conducted by Susan Yowell on July 16, 1974, in Mr. Meade's office in the East Wing of the White House. Testing 1, 2, 3, 4.
Is interested in a part-time job transcribing while she's in school. But right now we have about a 2-year backlog on transcribing just because of lack of staff.
And accelerating.
But hopefully at some time you will receive in the mail a copy of a draft transcript which you could go over and make any changes for. I guess the best way to start is just from the very beginning of when you first came to the White House. You were in the White House Fellows Program.
Yeah. Well, I came in as a White House Fellow to the Domestic Council. How about there?
This has a second microphone.
Well, I came to the White House on the Domestic Council as a White House Fellow. Working for Ed Morgan. And his areas of responsibility at that time were civil rights, Veterans Administration, most of the HEW programs, and the Department of Labor. And initially I worked in all of those with some emphasis on Jobs for Veterans, which was a new program, which was just being initiated at that time. Paul O'Neill and OMB and I worked on it. Still exists.
Could I backtrack for just a second before we go into your work on the Domestic Council? Could you tell me how you first came to learn about the White House Fellows Program and how you were? I know that you
went
through a very extensive...
Yeah, well, I knew some former fellows. Mm-hmm. There were two colonels out of Class 56 that I knew who were both selected as White House Fellows. And I was interested in it, and then when I was in Vietnam in 69, I applied from there through the Commander's Digest, which is a kind of a standard, you know, that's a journal that's published throughout the Army. And so I just followed up and competed from Vietnam. And then I was interested in, I had spent, of course, obviously in the Army all my time in national security, but also had specialized in graduate school, had taught the National Security Seminar at West Point, which is the major elective course in national security, had written 3 or 4 volumes of the Pentagon Papers, and also had done some work with the Chief of Staff's report. And I was steeped in national security policy and wanted to get into something else, so I was interested in domestic policy. And at Early House, Morgan and Cole both were on the commission that selected my group of fellows. So I got to know them then, and then when I asked for the Domestic Council, I came in. That's how I ended up working here.
I think that's pretty standard policy in the fellows program to put you in a field that is not necessarily part of your background.
Well, that's really the strength of it. The real problem arises when someone tries to either mistakenly or otherwise tries to capitalize upon somebody's experience. And, you know, what they do, they lose the broadening experience for the fellow. And really it ought to be that. It's designed to be that. In some cases it works, in others it doesn't. That's how I got here.
Okay, I didn't want to sidetrack you.
Yeah, sure.
I didn't want to go too far beyond that. You were working most closely with Ed Morgan then.
Yeah, well, I worked directly for him as a staff assistant. At the time, he was an assistant director. Then in, probably by late fall of that year, I worked exclusively with him in desegregation, primarily elementary and secondary desegregation. And in that function, we worked with Stan Pottinger, who was then the director of the Office of Civil Rights in HEW, with Peter Holmes, who was his deputy at the time, with Juris Leonard, who was then the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights in the Department of Justice. With the Attorney General, John Mitchell, John Ehrlichman, at that time Bob Mardian, who was still with the Cabinet Committee on Education, and Jim Clausen, who was one of his deputies in the Cabinet Committee on Education. And later, of course, there was a transition when Schultz, George Schultz, picked that up, and Morgan became kind of the executive director of it, and Jim Clausen came into the Domestic Council.
Was this a formal task force on desegregation?
No, it was an informal working group that met almost daily during that period. That was during the period of the most sensitive implementation of the various busing orders. It was also the fall when the Swan decision, Charlotte Mecklenburg, was handed down. Mm-hmm. And so we were most concerned in that period about potential for violence and the problems in kind of facilitating a smooth transition from a much different mode of operation in HEW and justice than they'd had previously, and that we were trying to place more emphasis upon negotiations and rather than kind of early court confrontations. And this is, of course, during the period when Leon Panetta and others accused the administration of backing down, but it wasn't a backing down as much as it was kind of a change in the theme and the thrust, the way of operating in desegregation. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the results pretty much speak for themselves. We got a much higher level of desegregation in those 3 years than we did in the three previous years when we went through this very kind of heavy confrontation type operation.
Were there any notes or minutes taken on the meetings that you all?
Well, Morgan's files are quite extensive in this area. Ehrlichman's files are extensive. And the desegregation files that I left are extensive. There's also a complete set, which is now, since the Cabinet Committee on Education is now defunct, there's a complete set of its records that are available.
Do you know where they are?
Well, they're in the White House somewhere. It's a Cabinet Committee.
Mm-hmm. Would the files themselves reflect the work or the contributions of the people?
Yes, they do. I've just been through them, and they're quite extensive, including the memoranda to the president, the memoranda to Ehrlichman, to the Cabinet Committee, and kind of the staff working papers. You know, since you're interested in this, there were memos done on a daily basis to the president on the desegregation situation from mid-August until mid-October, and they're all in the files with notations.
Was there any either formal or informal leader within this group? Was it?
Well, Morgan was as the White House man.
And were these meetings held in the White House?
No, well, they were held various places, sometimes in Justice, sometimes at HEW, sometimes here.
Okay. Then this work on desegregation, you said, was concentrated in the fall.
Well, desegregation is a lot like grape picking. It's seasonal. You tend to get a tremendous amount of very serious, intense activity and problems in the late summer and early fall during school openings, because that's the time when new plans are implemented, when kids are being reassigned to schools, when there's new busing, when there are changes in curricula, and so forth. The once you get over that hump, it gets less serious during the late fall. Then you go through kind of a minor peak period again in January during second semester. Prince George's County over here implemented its desegregation plan midterm, so there are a number of those throughout the country. And then it tails off. Then you get into the spring period when the court decisions are coming down. Most of the major Supreme Court decisions have come down in the spring, in order to, you know, provide time for development of orders and plans to be implemented the next school year. Like right now, although it's late, it's summer, we're waiting now for the Detroit decision. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you get a series of these decisions, which are kind of seasonal also. But that's why I said, you know, the activity then. This kind of peaked each year, except in 72, which we'll get to, when we had a peak of activity in the spring. And but this is during the period of the development of the president's legislation.
Were you more involved in reaction to the administration's policies, or were you actively involved in...
We were formulating
them. Formulating policy, legislation.
And implementing. That was one, you know, it was a rather operational aspect of the domestic council's activity, which is a little different than we do sometimes, but not necessarily.
Obviously, the people you mentioned are mostly in terms of policy input.
Mm-hmm.
But
well,
did you also work with offices such as the Congressional Liaison Office here?
Yeah, but... See, we're not involved in legislation yet at this stage, kind of. This is the 70-71 period. It's still kind of a period of implementation of existing legislation. The anti-busing proposals had not been made. Busing didn't become a serious political issue until 1972, although it did in a couple of isolated areas of the country become an issue in 1970. Clearly Charlotte-Mecklenburg, which was the genesis of the case, and then a couple of other areas. Tennessee had a number of them. But at that time we were still involved in implementing the Title IV and Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and still are for that matter. But the other legislative thrust, which has been to place reasonable limitations on busing and to create busing as a remedy only of the last resort, found its impetus in 70-71 period, but wasn't developed until 72.
Mm-hmm. And you were working on it.
Yeah, right. That comes later. You want to kind of...
Well,
okay.
All right. Why don't you just move on as you...
Okay, well, kind of peripheral to all of this, and although this was a kind of the central thrust of our efforts, I worked for Morgan also in the elementary and secondary education areas, in the other kind of education per se, working on, particularly at the time we were looking at policies toward vocational education, which later became career education. We were looking at ways of funding education, kind of from a general policy standpoint, where the money should be focused when you had limited resources. Should we try to focus exclusively on need? Should we develop some formulae to create a way of meeting most of the most serious need, but leave ways of getting into the lower middle class, for instance, where expenses of an expensive college education are just as heavily brought to bear as they are the poor, in a way. But that was kind of some of the activity that we're involved in. That gets into the 71 period, end of the fellows period. Now, the one other major kind of area of concern was the so-called sixth grade goals. And by November of 70, as the desegregation business tailed off, our activity in the other areas began to pick up, predominantly in the development of the revenue sharing proposals, general revenue sharing, and also special revenue sharing. Mm-hmm. At that time, there were only two or three people on the staff domestic council that had an economic background. I was one of them. And so they asked me if I would be the project manager, so-called, of the six special revenue sharing programs, and to work, try to develop those. And so I kind of shifted out of the desegregation business temporarily and began working on this special revenue sharing and devoted an awful lot of time between November and the next summer on the development of those proposals, on the individual messages that preceded each one before it was sent to the Hill and so forth. There's an extremely complete file available on all of those, the development of all of them. Those aren't only in my files, but they're in Ed Harper's files and Dick Nathan's files. Were Ray Waldman's files, they're all in the White House.
Were Harper, Nathan, and Waldman the three people who worked with you on this?
Yeah. Now, Harper had the lead for all of the development of the stuff. Waldman was working for Harper, so he was heavily involved. I was involved, and Nathan was involved from OMB. He was assistant director of OMB then. All of that is available, plus it's very extensively chronicled in the president's papers, messages to the Congress and everything. And plus there's legislation developed in it.
You mentioned that this was about the time that you were finishing up the fellows program. Was there really any substantive change in your work by the formal ending of the fellows program?
No. When I came in, I started to function as a staff assistant, and I just continued that pretty much. And the reason I mentioned the revenue sharing, that's probably, at that time, I was the only one that had anything much going on in that area, and that prompted John Ehrlichman and the president to ask me to stay. With kind of an informal agreement that I would leave in a year or a year and a half or so, whenever I thought I could get away.
It's lasted a little bit longer.
It's a little bit longer, right. That gets into late 71. Well, during the 71 period, primarily concerned with that legislation, special revenue sharing. And also, John asked me to begin to pick up some of the housing stuff for two reasons. The primary one was because of all the special revenue sharing proposals that appeared to have kind of the most merit and also looked like we might get it, was the Urban Community Development Revenue Sharing proposal, which was closely related to housing. Now, to show you how wrong you can be, right now we think that's going to be one we're going to get this summer. So it's we were a little bit wrong in our estimate.
Were you at any point involved in promoting the passage of the legislation?
Very actively. I spent a lot of time on the Hill, a lot of time working with the congressional guys, and a lot of time working with the HUD people, the general counsel, Dave Maxwell, Secretary Romney, and Undersecretary Van Dusen, as well as Ashley Ford, who was the Deputy General Counsel at the time, is now retired, and the Congressional Liaison people at HUD in trying to get that legislation through. But there were five other programs I was interested in: transportation, law enforcement, rural development, manpower, the urban one that we mentioned. Let's see if I can remember the sixth one. It's been a long time. Education. And so what I did, I set up kind of little working groups around each one of those areas. They consisted of usually their congressional liaison guy. In fact, he usually led it, although not always, there being the department's special legislative guy. Usually the assistant secretary who would be in charge of that area, for instance, manpower at the time, it was Mac Lovell. In education, we were using the commissioner of education, who then was Sid Marlin. Transportation, we had Don Kendall, who was then the deputy legislative liaison guy. But we had kind of various groups built around each one of these programs who kind of were charged with the responsibility to get the thing articulated on the Hill, to develop support for it, to identify the areas that needed to be approached force support, to find areas of compromise that we might have to make in order to gain support, to get the bill introduced, to do all of the kind of simple, you know, mechanical things also, as well as to do some of the more public things, preparation of speeches, speech inserts on it, and so forth. Kind of a rather concerted mini campaign around each one of those bills, but focused in the department rather than the domestic council. And then I just kind of orchestrated it.
Were there also people from the Congress included in these groups?
No.
At the time of formulation?
No. Well, we were working with them. Oh, during formulation? We did some congressional consultation prior to the development of the bill. We did a little less for two reasons. One was that this was going to be introduced as a new initiative by the President in the State of the Union message, and we felt that too much extensive consultation would preempt that. The other reason was that the basic nature of the programs was antithetical to much of what the Congress was interested in, because what we were doing was essentially dismantling the categorical grant program, which has a very extensive set of constituent interest both in the bureaucracy and on the Hill. And what we were doing was a kind of a direct frontal assault upon that system. And what we would have gotten would probably have been some backfires built up on the Hill even before we introduced it, if we did too much direct consultation on the issue.
Yeah.
And we took a lot of criticism for it. This is where some of the origination of the arrogance charges and so forth arose. But I think it's interesting, you know, you got to know the content of those charges, and partly because we're threatening what's a very dear portion of the Congress's pork.
Were your consultations on the Hill within the committees?
Yeah,
of the areas
primarily.
Concerned, or were they with the leadership?
Primarily. Although, the leadership, the early consultations were kind of with selected people. Later on, when we got the proposals developed, we brought the committees down, both majority and minority sides. The members brought them down here to the Roosevelt Room and actually briefed them. And in some cases made some rather significant adjustments in the proposals before they were sent to the Hill, and others we didn't make. Well, it depended on kind of the reaction, and also depended upon how positive the suggestions were. So it varied. And there were also, for instance, we talked to some of the ranking minority members on various committees that were essential, as far as we were concerned, in getting the bill introduced and developing some early support for it. And we had kind of mixed reactions there. In some committees we had good reaction, in others we had ranking minority members refuse to introduce the legislation.
One thing that is a sidelight to what you've been saying, but you did mention speech writing. Did you do any speaking for the administration?
Yeah, I think I've made probably 300 or 400 major speeches in 4 years. Everything from 10-person college seminars to 5,000 people.
And what was the general area in which you spoke?
Well, it depended on the audience.
Yeah.
Well, clearly the speeches were very substantive in nature, rather than political. And they were designed to try to explain some of the basic policy thrusts that we were pursuing, from emphasis upon creating a broader range of individual choice in ways that people don't really realize that these policies do that, to creating a structure of greater responsibility for state and local government, for ways of focusing responsibility in government and thereby increasing its responsiveness and thereby increasing its credibility. And then relating these directly to programs and policies that we're developing and initiating. And then across the entire range of substantive areas, See, as I go on, you're going to see that there's almost no area in domestic policy that I haven't spent a little bit of time in, so I know just enough to be dangerous in each one. So I could talk to people about mass transit, urban mass transit, or I could talk to people about most kind of esoteric approaches to career education, to the court cases and desegregation, to the open housing court suits, to housing allowances, the home rule in the district, and you know, all the areas in between. So a lot of it, like if I were talking to a group of graduate students who were primarily interested in economics, so I'd talk about the economics of some of our housing programs, for instance. If I were talking to a bunch of contractors, I could talk to them about the economic potential of Operation Independence. But, you know, so substantively they varied, but the policy thrusts were generally the same.
And did you write your own speeches?
Yes.
Did you convey five?
Yeah. Yes, but I've got that.
Okay.
That's in my papers.
All right. Well, I didn't mean to
I don't
say
know.
That.
I don't know if they. Well, there may be copies in the other papers. I don't know, because I don't know what all Trudy Fry kept. I haven't been through my boxes.
And maybe asking you to see that there is a set that's left with the files. Mm-hmm. Public speaking can be very revealing to the administration's focus.
Yeah, I assume they're. Well, I don't know.
Did you send all the files that you were taking over to Trudy Fry?
She's been through everything.
She's probably
got them, and I don't. And I haven't gone back into the boxes to find out what's there and what isn't. So, and I took very little with me.
Okay. Well, I didn't mean to sidetrack you. Mm-hmm. Back on, I guess we were housing and transportation.
Well, then comes 70. By early 72, it became apparent to the president that he had to do something about the busing business. We were facing a raft of court cases throughout the country, which were going to lead to very extensive busing. Once the Swan decision came down, and what Swan did in a rather ambiguous way was to say that busing was an acceptable remedy for cases, desegregation cases. And when this happened, a lot of the district courts began to grab hold of desegregation cases and write pretty extensive busing orders. They also began to embellish these busing orders with interesting nuances like consolidation. Judge Marriage in Richmond came out with a consolidation order, which had a rather novel approach that you could not only not have racially identifiable schools side by side in the same district, but now you can no longer have racially identifiable school districts side by side. And this was fueled really, and we realized it, by economics as much as by education. A lot of the center cities were going black very quickly, and as a result they were losing their tax base. As they lost their tax base, their school funds began to dry up. As their school funds began to dry up, the school districts began to disintegrate. And one of the ways that the inner city school boards and judges saw as to keep the money in those school districts was to enjoin them with the suburban districts. You know, bring in the Grosse Pointes, the Bloomfield Hills into the Detroit Central District. Bring Chesterfield and Rico counties around Richmond into the central city of Richmond. Bring the Lexingtons, the Concords, the Wellesleys, the Newtons into the Boston center city. Bring Clayton Ledoux into St. Louis center city, and so forth. So we began to see that this consolidation thing was going to begin churning up and create real problems. Indianapolis was already facing a consolidation suit. And Judge Roth in Detroit was handing one down, which brought in 53 suburban districts without even having a day in court, with no indication that they were even discriminating. And then we had the Richmond one. So the president decided that we should go ahead and begin to develop some kind of a positive kind of legislation to get a handle on this thing. At the same time, we were facing increased pressure on the Hill for a constitutional amendment to outlaw busing. And I think that most people around here felt that the constitutional amendment probably should be only the last resort, and the legislation would be much faster, which it would be, and also much more certain. There was no certainty we could ever get a constitutional amendment. So John Ehrlichman was asked to put together a task force to do a couple things. One was to analyze the various constitutional amendment proposals and try to determine which one, if the president were to support one, was probably the most viable. Secondly, to begin to look at ways of legislatively attacking the problem of busing. Well, to make a very long story short, this group went to Camp David for about 4 days and worked about 18 hours a day on this project, developed paper for the president. That is very extensively covered in everyone's files. The participants up there, Ehrlichman, Todd Holland was with him, Ralph Erickson, who was then the about to become the Deputy Attorney General, Will Hastings, who was then the General Counsel of HGW, Paul O'Neill, Associate Director of OMB, Ed Morgan, myself, Jim Clausen, who by that time was a staff assistant over here working in the domestic council with Morgan on busing and desegregation. Those are the prime actors. I'm sure, like, my files reflect that output. Morgan's files, I know, do. I had them. When he left, I took his files, and then they've since gone to central files. But Ehrlichman files reflect it. Okay, we came back from Camp David for a week. And then, after the president decided to go ahead with the legislation, a group, and I didn't go back up there, I stayed down here to man the fort since we had about 15 other things going on, but Ray Price, Morgan, Clausen, Hastings, and O'Neill, I believe, went back, possibly with Schultz, and drafted the speech and began to kind of refine the legislation that we had drafted the week before. Out of that came three things. The Equal Education Opportunities Act of 1972, which is kind of the basic document upon which most anti-busing legislation has been based since then. The Esch Amendment, which is on the Hill now, attached to the education bill, is really that bill, the Equal Education Opportunities Act, minus Title I, which was the money title. That was one thing came out. Second thing was the Student Transportation Moratorium of 1972, which was nothing but a small piece of legislation designed to put a moratorium on all busing orders until the Congress had a chance to address the Equal Education Opportunities Act of 72. And finally, the major presidential message, which was delivered on March 17th, 1972. Very long. Message which laid out the president's kind of basic philosophy on busing and desegregation, and then went into the actual proposals themselves.
Then your input into that was at this initial 4 day.
Well, I also coordinated the final preparation of it down here.
You coordinated that with the speechwriters.
We had some other things we were doing related to this. One was we were testing the constitutionality of it. And we brought, this the first time I saw Charles Allen Wright was brought up from Texas as a constitutional expert. Bob Bork was brought in to look at it. We had Alex Bickel look at it. We brought in three lawyers from Kidder and Ellis in Chicago to take a look at it. Hamilton Chaffetz was the lead guy. Also, we brought in, wish I knew the dates, my files would reflect. We brought in the black appointees in the administration to look at the proposals and to give us their comments in writing, which they did. They sent the president a very long 40-page memo, which is in the files.
It was a composite reaction.
Right. We brought in two groups of national black leaders to discuss kind of the outlines of the proposals. And this ran the gamut from Clarence Mitchell to Roy Innes to Roy Abernathy to all the responsible national black leaders.
Did you send out any censors to the Hill?
Oh, well, then, yeah, then we started working. We did the same thing with the Hill. And we briefed every part of the spectrum up there and talked to every part of the spectrum. From the most conservative, who were adamant in their support of a constitutional amendment and opposed legislation, to the moderates who were willing to go anyway as long as some kind of reasonable, as long as two things, a reasonable limit on the remedy was imposed and that we didn't damage or didn't deflect the thrust of desegregation as it existed in the country at the time, which was kind of pretty much the basic approach that we were pursuing. And finally, to the most liberal, who took the view that any kind of limitation on busing would pretty much derail the progress that was being made desegregation. This went on for a considerable period of time, and then the Judiciary Committees began to hold hearings on the legislation, and we got involved there in preparing witness lists and getting witnesses ready to go to the Hill and preparing documentation, making a public case, and so forth.
Did you testify?
No. The domestic counsel doesn't testify.
Oh.
One guy goes up a year, one time a year, and that's Ken Cole, or the director goes up and testifies on our budget. And that's all. And as a matter of policy, we don't. Now, we work on preparing testimony for other people to go up and for agencies and declare testimony. The other thing that happened, we got very involved in actually the legislative mechanics and the development of the bill as it went through. And in the summer of 72, the House passed the Equal Education Opportunities Act by a pretty good margin. The Senate filibustered it to death, and the session ended before the election without any kind of final passage of the legislation. Nothing happened in early 73 on anti-busing legislation for a number of reasons. One was that there was very little busing activity in the country. There were only a couple busing orders that came down. Both of them lost on appeal. Secondly, there were three Detroit Supreme Court type decisions that were being waited on, and no one wanted to do anything till they got them. One was the Denver decision. Another was the Detroit decision, and the other was the Richmond decision. To this point, we have two of those. Both of them, one, Richmond was a draw, which left it inconclusive as precedent. Denver came down in such ambiguity that nobody can figure out what it says. And we're waiting for Detroit.
Was it Rehnquist that abstained from voting on the...
Powell abstained from Richmond, because he'd been a member of the school board.
That's right.
Which is too bad.
I guess Rehnquist wasn't even a member.
I don't know if he was or not. I think he was. Well,
that was pretty close.
Yeah, but 4-4 was because Powell did abstain. So things were rather quiet. Now, of course, now the Yesh Amendment, which, as I said, is the EOA minus Title I, which has been stripped out and put into the bill in other ways, is, you know, the major kind of hang-up issue on the education bill on the Hill today. And if the House conferees have been instructed to stand tough on the Yesh Amendment, they went to conference, they couldn't get an agreement with the Senate, they went back to the House floor, and they were re-instructed. So there's a very good chance that some kind of rather clear anti-busing legislation is going to come out on that education bill. We think it's going to. So it's been, again, 2 years later, but that'll come out. Well, all of that gets, yeah.
Oh, well, I didn't, if you can go on, fine. I just wanted to ask you, this is about the time that they started the counselor system, which was very short.
About, yeah, I'm going to get, yeah, okay, I'll get to that.
All right.
Let's go to the election. Well, after the election, of course, the president began to look at ways of trying to strengthen the staff system and also the contact the staff had directly with counselors. And to begin, you know, frankly, to try to administratively organize the government along functional lines, as we tried to do legislatively with the reorganization proposals and hadn't been able to pull it off. And so we started the counselors. Now, domestic council was also going through kind of a period of reorganization. The kind of old line assistant directors, the people who had been their first term assistant directors, were now either moving up or out. Morgan went to Treasury, Krogh went to Transportation, Whitaker went to Interior, and then the people that had been kind of groomed as their deputies during all this period became assistant directors. I became an assistant director, Dick Fairbanks became an assistant director. Well, Harper left and we kind of dissolved that function. Jeff Shepard, who had worked for Krogh, picked up part of that crime and drugs and became an assistant director and so forth. So we kind of had a major reorganization within here. Ken became the executive director of the domestic council, and John stayed as the assistant to the president for domestic affairs. At the same time, we brought in the counselors, and what we did was we tried to match up an assistant director on each counselor. And so I became the assistant director for community development. Matched up on Jim Lynn. Dick Fairbanks became the assistant director for natural resources and was matched up on Earl Butts. Jim Cavanaugh became the associate director for human resources and was matched up on Cap Weinberger. And then at that time, I picked up other responsibilities which kind of clustered around community development, in addition to housing, which I'd been in for some time, and community development. Picked up all the disaster assistance function. Picked up rural development, which I'd been around a little bit because of the special revenue sharing. Picked up all of the transportation, which for me was new. And inherited from Krogh all of the District of Columbia. What else I was doing. Well, and then with Morgan's departure, I inherited all civil rights stuff and the busing. And then at that juncture, of course, I faced the other decision was whether or not to go back to work in the Army. And because, again, I was offered the new job and promotion and all the other stuff, the president asked me to stay, so I agreed to stay. During that, well, the council, do you want to ask know any more about the counselor business?
Was there really a major change in working relationships within the domestic council other than a change in personnel with the counselor system, or was it more superimposing a level on top, or did it really change?
There wasn't from our standpoint. There wasn't. I don't think very much change in kind of the mode of operation. We had always pretty much operated under the premise that the best way to do our job was to make sure that the cabinet secretaries had as much opportunity to perform their function as they could. In other words, to kind of minimize the amount of White House activity, and at the same time develop as good a relationship as we could. Now, the counselor system created there was paradox in the counselor system, in that you get the way we were organized, extremely close to one cabinet secretary. And to make it work, to make the counselor system work right, you had to give him all the support you could. At the same time, he was concerned with coordinating a number of his peers, who felt that under the old system that they always had pretty much direct access in here, and that we had always kind of nurtured that access with them. And suddenly there was this kind of slippage in the system. So it made it, it was a very difficult situation actually to handle. The one thing it did, which was really positive, was it got a lot of cabinet secretaries thinking in terms of the other guy's business. Now, the other guy didn't think that's such an advantage, but we've had a tremendous carryover from that in cabinet secretaries who've remained. Jim Lynn still has some kind of at least a latent interest and knowledge about rural development, which has helped us out a lot. Claude Brenniger takes greater interest in how communities develop, and won an interest far beyond the more parochial aspect of transportation than he ever would have had he not been involved in the counselor system. So we got some payoff there. It was not in operation long enough to really tell if it would ever work kind of to coordinate policy on a functional basis. Now, we've tried to build upon some of that experience lately. In the last 8 or 9 months, we've put together a series of domestic council committees on functional lines, chaired by cabinet secretaries, leading each one. But there, we've got clearly the advantage of being able to match up the committee on the individual and on the lead department. For instance, the domestic council committee on transportation policy is chaired by the Secretary of Transportation, who is kind of the obvious guy to chair transportation. So you don't get this problem that we had where the Secretary of HUD was really chairing, if you will, in the counselor system, coordination of policy not only for transportation but for rural development for the others. So we've tried to capitalize upon the good, the less abrasive side of the counselor system, and try to in our own domestic council committee system. But that was very short-lived, that was 3 months, and that was gone. Then we launched into kind of the so-called battle of the budget. And I was intimately involved in a number of those aspects, from civil rights, where we were debating whether to spend the kind of money that we had proposed in the Equal Education Opportunities Act, which was $2.5 billion, on concentrating on so-called disadvantaged children, which is a euphemism really for minority in most parts of the country, to how much money we would spend on the subsidized housing programs, to the termination of many of the community development programs, and so on. Unfortunately, most of the hard nuts that we bit off were all in my area. The acorns that we had were all in housing and in community development and so forth, where we took the committees head on and just terminated the programs. The one thing we did in order to buy time and to try to find a better way of applying a lot of this federal money was initiate this big housing study, which we did, which took the better part of 6 months of my time between April and September, culminating in the housing message on September 19th. Now, the files are very extensive on that, too.
And they would show who worked on this.
They would show who worked on it, all of the drafts. What it amounted to, actually, was Paul O'Neill, Jim Lynn, and I sitting down for a marathon 72 hours and finally writing the housing message.
You mentioned that you picked up the area of District of Columbia Affairs from
Crow.
From Crow when he left. Was this after the Office of Intergovernmental Relations had been taken away from the Office of the Vice President?
Yes. But, you know, one thing that we've never done until now, and we are doing it now, we've always treated the District of Columbia as a special entity. We've never treated it as another local government because of the clear differences in the federal relationship in the district. Krogh devoted most of his time on the District of Columbia to crime and drugs. By the time I got it, we were pretty much out of that phase. I mean, we had that under control. We were also not facing the same kind of civil disorder problem that we had in the 70s, early 70, 71. That's, you know, May Day and the riots and so forth. Instead, we were facing three really important issues in the district. The first was home rule. Second was the physical development of the district. Everything from the metro to rebuilding the riot quarters to Fort Lincoln to the Civic Center to the Visitor Center to the highway system. And third was the bicentennial. The city clearly is going to be the one that's going to benefit most from the bicentennial, is also going to suffer most. You know, we're going to have 35 million people in here in 76. Every major international convention in the world would hold its convention here in 76 if there was a place to do it. Every country in the world wants to have something going on in Washington in 76. I mean, you know, that's kind of the magnitude. So those were kind of the areas that I spent most of my time. Now, clearly the first year was on home rule. And of course we finally got a bill, which I think most of us feel is a pretty good one, is kind of a halfway house between complete autonomy and some way of protecting the federal interest during a period when we really don't understand exactly what home rule is going to do and how it's going to work out.
What kind of staff did you have in the District of Columbia Affairs?
I had nobody in the Domestic Council. I had two people in OMB who worked for me on the district. Art Callan and Bill Leonard.
I know that Bud Crowe had a woman lawyer, Sally Ann Benton.
Bud had Sally Ann, who worked on the district exclusively. Shepard spent a lot of time in crime and drugs in the district. Bud also had two or three people in OMB who did it.
You must have had to draw upon the
agencies quite a bit. Well, see, I was very close to HUD, for instance, and most of the physical problems in the city are housing and community development. So I've always had kind of a little cell of people over in HUD who worked on these areas and that, you know, knew about them and could handle them and that I could rely upon.
Were you relying upon Princess Anne Armstrong's office on the bicentennial at this time?
See, we've always had someone that followed the bicentennial also, pretty much working in conjunction with Anne Armstrong. Now, we moved away from that considerably as she picked it up. And now we kind of monitor it, you know, just from a policy standpoint, because we still have the responsibility. We don't have all of the responsibility. She does. But we're much more deeply involved in it early than we are now. Also, the district has so much of the bicentennial activity in it that we were very, I was deeply involved in the development of the bicentennial stuff in the district. And then also the district, you know, for years had a special bicentennial coordination center headed by Bill Hart, quartered over in GSA. And that's very thoroughly covered my files too, all of that. In fact, the Home Rule files are very extensive also. I did a great deal of work up on the Hill on that. In fact, I was up there 5, 6, 7, 8 times a week for sessions with everybody. And that's all in there. They're in Cron's.
Are there any of these areas that you have mentioned, the broad areas which you feel would not be well documented in the files, or which would be documented more clearly in the files of another White House staff or in the agencies, or where one would have to go outside?
Yeah. Well, there are kind of sub-areas. For instance, the Visitor Center. This is all district stuff right now. The Visitor Center, much more clearly, the files of the Department of the Interior, since it's a Park Service project, would be more clearly outlined. Fort Lincoln, you'd almost have to go to the city's files and RLA. They'd have a lot more. Home Rule, almost exclusively done out of here, so it's most clearly covered here. Everything else, I think, you know, the district, my district files are pretty complete.
Mm-hmm.
And Crowe's were relatively complete.
The extent of the files themselves would probably then reflect the extent of your actual involvement.
Yeah, pretty well. Although, unlike a lot of people, I don't do a lot of memos for record. And I don't write a lot of memos. I mean, some people, you know, live on grinding out 80 memos a day. But, you know, the trend and the thread is all there. And the major exchange of information and the major memos and the decision memos are all in there. So that's pretty well reflected.
Okay. Were there other major areas that you haven't
The only other kind of major shift is in early 74, early this year, then I became Cole's deputy. And kind of broadened my activity across all the areas. And we've got about 5 more minutes.
All right. Well, you are now Cole's deputy.
Yeah, I'm now Cole's deputy. And, well, and then with just kind of broader responsibilities across all of the domestic council stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I've performed that pretty much since January.
Was there any major change when Cole became head of the domestic council?
Well, see, he had run the domestic council staff pretty much since before the election, 72. He formally was the executive director of the staff from, I guess, February or January of 73. With the exception of two or three of us that worked with Ehrlichman directly on some issues, like I worked pretty much directly with Ehrlichman on civil rights, he had been the guy that all the assistant directors had worked with and for that whole period. So in that regard, in that respect, nothing much was different. What really became different was when Ken became the assistant to the president in January or February this year. And then, you know, kind of needed the executive officer or the executive type guy under him to coordinate the activity of the staff. And that's why we suddenly needed a deputy.
Would you say that you more or less filled a role that Cole had filled when he had been executive director?
Well, partially.
Is this what you're...
Partially, yeah. I filled a combination of the role that Cole fulfilled for Ehrlichman when he was the deputy of the domestic council. Ehrlichman was both executive director and assistant to president. And part of the function that Cole performed himself when he was the executive director only, it was an assistant to president. The elevation put him into a whole new series of responsibilities and kind of meetings and contacts and public activity that made it impossible for him to kind of coordinate and run the day-to-day activity of the staff, and that's what the deputy had to pick up, which probably is.
So you picked up probably much more the line of administrative responsibility.
Yep, and gradually began to shed kind of the detailed substantive involvement that I'd had.
I don't want to keep you too long, but one of the things that we're interested in trying to pinpoint now are areas that people feel that they should and could talk about in a more in-depth oral history project. Since you covered so many areas, I'm sure it's a very difficult question for you to single out areas which would not be well documented in the files and which would have a long-run significance. But are there any areas that would stand out in your mind?
Well, there are a number of them. One is the civil rights area. Another is the whole development of the basic new federalism thrust, revenue sharing, reorganization, and so forth. Another one is the home rule thing, which has not been, the president hasn't had, I don't think, a fair shake on it. And there's a kind of an interesting historical development of the whole thing. I mean, it goes all the way back into the mid-1800s. Another is kind of basically the institutionalization of the policy process, the domestic policy process in the White House. In fact, I'm going to do some writing about that.
You mean the whole formation of the domestic council?
Right, relationship to OMB, the development of the counselors, the whole.
Okay, and I don't want to push too much, but who's picking up most of your responsibilities when you
Well, Andre Buckles is going to pick up D.C. Jeff Shepard's going to pick up civil rights. Jim Kavanaugh is going to become the deputy. Mike DeVal is going to pick up the transportation piece from me, Todd Hall and the HUD pieces, and the disaster assistance pieces, which, by the way, is a whole other area that could be covered in some depth. Yeah. Very broad.
Taken up more by the domestic council from the OMB at this later period?
Mm-hmm. But we had always had some responsibility in it, but we kind of broadened our activity.
I think that Frank Carlucci. At one time.
Well, he had Agnes. Remember, he was sent up there to coordinate
right,
Agnes.
The, yeah, Wilkes-Barre. Right.
But that shifted too.
Mm-hmm. Did you work very closely with OMB on disaster, or had it really shifted almost?
Well, as far as we worked. Remember, I don't know how much you know about this. There was a major study that was initiated pursuant to Agnes. Try to take a look across the board at all of the ways of better providing disaster relief and assistance. We were one of the two major participants in that law with OMB. After that, we prepared and presented to the Congress three pieces of legislation: the Disaster Assistance Act 1973, Flood Insurance Act, and some amendments to the existing disaster legislation. Well, we had responsibility for that. We also have final responsibility for coordination of all disaster declaration requests that go to the president and coordinate the staff recommendations to develop information for the president upon which to base his decision and for communicating those to the governors and others.
So this was probably also a result of your picking up the area of intergovernmental relations.
Community development.
Okay. I guess from the time that you were with first with Morgan, and then as you picked up these different policy areas, you worked with a number of people on the staff and didn't have a staff of your own per se. As you became assistant director, and even before that, did you have a formal chain of command underneath you? In other words, who were your major staff assistants?
Todd Holland and Mike DeVal.
Okay.
John Garland. In the DC stuff, Bill Leonard, Art Callan, Owen B. Shepard has worked for me on the civil rights stuff.
Most of these were just on the basis of the particular policy area you were involved in.
Well, Todd and Mike both worked directly for me.
This was
across all the areas.
On a more continuing basis.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And what about even your secretary? She would probably be the one most familiar with your files.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've had two secretaries for the last 2 years, Virginia Whitehead and Judy Johnson. And they're both very familiar with them. They've cataloged them and everything.
And prior to that,
Nora Vandersomen, who now works for Bud Linebaugh, still in the building. Prior to that, Jan Bird, who's gone.
Even though right now, for the most part, we're not interviewing secretaries at all. Sometimes they're the key.
Right. Well, the first two there would both know.
Okay.
They know all about the files.
Do you have a permanent forwarding address? Where you might be reached?
286 Old Main Street, South Yarmouth.
Yarmouth.
Massachusetts. 02664.
And is that a family?
That's a home, yeah.
Okay.
They always will know where I am, some way.
Okay. Well, I know you're continuing in the military.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going up. Is it
West Point? Yeah. I can give that address, too.
Oh, all right. I'll put it
in. I mean, that's a bit. I'll be there in a month.
All right.
Professor and deputy head, Department of Social Sciences. USMA, West Point, New York. 10996.
996.
Yeah.
Okay. Was there anything else that you would like to add on as a general area that should be gone into?
Except, you know, if you do go on in some of these areas, I'd like to be interviewed on some of them.
Okay.
On those other areas.
Well, I certainly hope that the Nixon Library will
get
the go-ahead
at
some
it.
Point to do this, because I think it's received pretty good response of the other libraries, and hopefully we'll get the approval for that. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.